Good morning. Our first case for this morning, first case for 2008, is United States against Hart. This will be a 20-minute per side argument. Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, may it please the court. I am Major Shannon Bennett, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Dustin M. Hart. The issue before this court is whether the charge and its specifications should be dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction. And what the issue boils down to is whether the second element of the King test was met in this case. Under the facts and circumstances specific to this particular case, they were. In this case, the appellant urges this court to adopt the following analysis for the second element of the King test: that the final pay is ready as of the date of separation if a member has properly cleared finance and finance has everything in their possession necessary to determine the final accounting of pay. The old analysis of physical possession of a paycheck simply doesn't work anymore. In the old days, the paycheck had to be ready as of the date of separation because an airman physically went to finance, picked up their paycheck, and departed base. Now, technological advances and electronic fund transfer make this paycheck in hand concept no longer valid. In this case, the appellant had his final appointment to out-process finance on the 24th of February. At that time, he brought all of his properly completed finance-specific out-processing checklist to the finance office and turned it in. On the 26th of February, DFAS computed their initial calculation of their snapshot of his final pay. So at that time, the Charleston finance office had everything in their possession necessary to calculate the appellant's final pay, but instead, because of their own administrative procedure, chose not to do so and even start until sometime after the date of separation. And that was the process they followed for all the cases there at Charleston. It wasn't just specific to the appellant's case. Application of the appellant's proposed analysis is in keeping with the DFAS regulation. The DFAS regulation requires the local finance office, at the date of separation minus 4 days, to obtain a member's LES, manually calculate the pay, compare that calculation to the DFAS snapshot, and make any necessary adjustments. The intention behind that is to ensure that the member gets their final pay on their date of separation. Furthermore, the appellant's analysis would provide for a defined moment of discharge, which is in keeping with United States versus Scott and United States versus Howard. Looking at the testimony at trial and the DFAS regulation, it becomes apparent that employing a paycheck-in-hand rule could lead to any number of moments of discharge, which would raise grave constitutional...
Are you asking us to disregard 10 U.S.C. 1168?
No, Your Honor, but we're just asking for a development of a rule that provides for some sort of safeguard in cases like this, where the government wasn't following their own regulations.
So that makes good, may make good legal policy sense, but are you arguing that in this case, his final pay or a substantial part of that pay was ready for delivery?
Not under the technical standpoint as it's been defined in the past, but under the facts of this case.
Defined by whom?
By this court and the lower courts, Your Honor.
Okay. Not by DFAS.
No, Your Honor.
So the military judge got it right in his findings of fact?
No, Your Honor.
What did he get wrong, and what did he get wrong that indicates that, in fact, a substantial part of the pay was ready for delivery? Where is that reflected in the record?
It's the...
Two questions there.
Yes, sir. The appellant doesn't contend that any of the findings of fact in Appellate Exhibit 21 were particularly wrong, but we contend that the judge should have properly considered the additional findings 8 of the 9 findings of fact that the trial defense counsel asked him to consider in Appellate Exhibit 24. It appears in this case that the military judge was simply picking and choosing which facts to put in, and only put in the facts that were beneficial to the government and tended to show no final accounting. Whereas when you took...
So what then that leads to question number 2. What in the record indicates that, in fact, a substantial part of the pay was ready for delivery?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our contention that because the appellant in this case had completed the finance-specific checklist, which showed the only outstanding debt he owed to anyone on the base was the approximately $1,000 he owed to AFIS, and finance had in their possession everything necessary to calculate it, that equates to a final accounting of pay purposes for meeting the definition under 1168.
Where does the word final accounting of pay appear in 1168?
It appears in, well, it says that a final pay or a substantial part of that pay is ready for delivery.
Right. That doesn't say final accounting for pay, does it?
Not so.
Where does that phrase come from?
That phrase, I believe, comes from United States versus King.
And does United States versus King make that a mandatory requirement?
Yes, Your Honor.
It does? What does the word generally mean in United States versus King?
Well, it means that it's fact-specific, Your Honor.
So does it have to be a final accounting of pay in every case if the court said use the word generally and they referred to a phrase that's not in the statute?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And that's what the appellant's position is that in this case, when you look at the particular facts, it basically is the equivalent of a final accounting of pay because it was ready but for the failure on the part of the office at the Charleston finance office to calculate that final pay.
How does the fact that they get something like a 20-day post-discharge window to complete this cut into this? Would court-martial jurisdiction survive post-discharge if they're fiddling around in the 20-day window?
It's the appellant's position that it doesn't exist, doesn't continue, Your Honor, under these facts and circumstances of this case. The DFAS regulation requires the finance office to have completed their final manual calculation of pay at the date of separation minus 4 days so that they can get paid. And if the government is allowed to argue all of these different parts of the DFAS regulation, they could really ask this court to present any number of moments of discharge, which would lead to disparate results from case to case. For example,
doesn't the DFAS reg allow 20 days after ETS to complete manual calculation of pay?
It doesn't specifically say that, as Tech Sergeant Wooden accounts for. It does give the local finance office basically access to the master military pay account up to 20 days after the date of separation. According to his testimony and a read of the DFAS regulation, at that date of separation plus 20 days, the master military pay account locks up as far as Charleston Air Force Base's access to it, and at that point in time, it can only be accessed by DFAS.
So they can make corrections within that 20-day period?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any part of the regulation that permits them to not provide a final accounting of pay at the time of separation?
I don't believe so.
And do we have any case that stands for the proposition that when the government violates its own regulations with respect to the preparation of final pay, that permits the government to retain court-martial jurisdiction? Any of those cases that you mentioned before with respect to final accounting of pay, do any of them stand for the proposition that if the government violates its own regulations with respect to the final accounting of pay, it can nonetheless retain court-martial jurisdiction past the time that a DD-214 is provided to the individual?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. If you look at Smith v. Vanderbush, this court discussed how the DFAS regulation at that point in time, I believe it allowed up to 30 days after the date of separation for them to make adjustments. This court said that would not allow the military to obtain court-martial jurisdiction when otherwise they could have accounted for the pay. Counsel, within the meaning of the statute 1168, was the final pay or substantial part of the pay actually ready? And I'm not asking you whether it should have been ready. I'm asking whether it was ready for delivery, which is a different question, whether it had been a final accounting or whether there was a paycheck in hand.
Yes, ma'am. As is stated in paragraph 19 of the judge's findings of fact, according to Ms. Kane, the finance technician, they hadn't done a lot of the manual calculation. They hadn't started the manual calculation. So they had the DFAS snapshot in time, which showed what was their initial calculation, but it hadn't taken into account things such as that AFI's debt that would offset that final pay.
Well, so you have a snapshot. Could you say that the snapshot provides that a substantial part of the pay is ready for delivery? They have some idea of what's due him. The statute doesn't say that it has to be calculated. The statute says that it or a substantial part has to be ready for delivery.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's our position. Our position is the regulation allows for so much adjustment after the fact that you need to set a defined moment of discharge. And in this particular case, with these facts, because DFAS had done their snapshot and we know there's only one outstanding debt, that was a substantial accounting of pay. And the DFAS regulation allows for DFAS to make any adjustments after the master military pay account is closed. The government, if we don't define it as our position is, the government could argue that the moment of discharge isn't until any residual pay might be given to the member from DFAS Denver, and DFAS Denver doesn't even do that review until the date of separation plus 20 days. Likewise, if the member is indebted to the service, the government could argue that the moment of discharge doesn't occur until DFAS notifies that member of their indebtedness and either collects the money back or takes them through involuntary collection. Likewise, this paycheck in hand rule could cause disparate results from base to base.
But is the government arguing that there has to be a paycheck in hand, or are they arguing that there has to be that the final pay or substantial part of the pay has to be ready for delivery, meaning that it has to be calculated so that they could cut a final check? I mean, let's be fair about what the government's arguing.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe their position is that it has to be, the final pay or a substantial part has to be ready for delivery. But when you look at the testimony at trial, I believe the government's position is that the manual calculation has to be done. They have to have gone through the review with Texard Wooden. They have to go through the QE review and have to have it in the system for DFAS. So maybe they don't have to actually have it deposited into their bank account, but it has to at least be back at DFAS. I mean, it seems like the government feels that it must be much closer to that than what we have in this case. For example, if the Shaw Air Force Base Finance Office has a great section that gets everything done in accordance with the DFAS regulation, but Charleston employs this rule of 20 days after the date of separation is good enough, then that member at Charleston is going to potentially be subject to court-martial jurisdiction for 20 days after their date of separation, whereas the member at Shaw Air Force Base will be separated and not subject to court-martial jurisdiction past their date of separation. There's no justifiable reason for these disparate results. One other issue I'd like to address is the government contends they put on evidence at trial that the squadron commander did not intend to discharge the appellant, but rather intended to prefer court-martial charges against him. And a review of the record as it stood on the date of separation, the 3rd of March, shows this wasn't the case. The only place in the record where it affirmatively states that they did not intend to discharge the appellant, but instead intended to prefer court-martial charges against him, was in Appellate Exhibit 8, a letter written by Captain Palmer, the acting squadron commander, 2 days after the date of separation. And the case law in this area actually requires not only intent, an examination of the squadron commander's intent, but the intent as it's communicated to the appellant. And in this case, if you look at the facts, nothing was communicated to the appellant about anything other than an intent to discharge him. He was...
Counsel, did the military judge at all rely on intent?
He discusses it a little bit, but he doesn't really... He didn't put that in his conclusions of law.
It was in his conclusion of law solely based on the final accounting of pay concept.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The appellant had been granted permissive TDY. His unit had signed off on his out-processing checklist, not once but twice, and it was a member of the command who did that. He was never told that he had been placed on administrative hold, and no one had told him he was going to be court-martialed. Furthermore, this showing of intent can't be retroactive. All of the cases dealing with intent deal with a revocation prior to the date of separation or on the same day, not after the fact. And if that was the case, in every one of these cases, the squadron could simply say, after the fact, we didn't intend to court-martial or we didn't intend to discharge this individual. A finding that the final pay is ready as of the date of separation, when a member has cleared finance and finance has everything in their possession necessary to calculate the final pay, is the appropriate analysis for the second element of King. For these reasons, the appellant respectfully requests this honorable court dismiss the charge and its specifications for lack of personal jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Jason Kalafer, and I, along with Colonel Joel Reed, represent the United States. In the present instance, the United States Air Force maintained personal jurisdiction over appellant because there was a failure to meet all of the elements as set forth in King to effectuate an early discharge. Moreover, there was no intent to effectuate an early discharge in this case.
Well, then what was AFPC doing?
Well, by AFPC, their act...
The Secretary of the Air Force directed his discharge.
Yes, sir. And
well,
I understand that. However,
isn't that dispositive?
Well, no, I don't believe it's dispositive, sir. I think the actions of the intent and the actions of the squadron commander need to be reviewed in order to determine whether or not the discharge is effective, because in this case, the commander's actions of setting or at least agreeing with the hold letter, effectively nullified the discharge actions that were subsequently taken.
Was that pre or post ETS?
That was pre, sir.
What was ETS?
I believe it was the 5th of March was his separation. However, on, I believe, 9 January, there was a administrative hold letter that was sent out. And that administrative hold letter is the reason there was no concern by the commander that there would be a discharge of the appellant.
Counsel, why don't you focus on whether or not the second requirement of Section 1168, as discussed in King and Harmon, was satisfied in this case, as opposed to the intent to discharge him or things of that nature.
Yes, ma'am. This court in United States versus King took a look at sections 1168, 1169, and set forth a test. And that test has three elements. One of those elements is that there be a final accounting of pay ready for delivery. And as was noted, section 1168 doesn't specifically state a final accounting. However, what I would say with regard to that.
Are you intentionally reading out the substantial part?
No, sir, not at all. However, what I am trying to get at is that while it doesn't say a final accounting of pay, it actually states a final pay or substantial portion of that pay, which would appear to be more restrictive than what King said in there being a final accounting of pay.
Well, I'll ask you what I ask the defense. The statute says the pay or a significant portion thereof They had a snapshot. They had a pretty good idea of what was due him. Isn't that a significant portion thereof?
They had a preliminary idea of what a significant portion of it would be. Yes.
Yes.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
However,
then why doesn't that comply with the statute?
For two reasons. First of all, it was not ready for delivery. And that is specifically what the statute states, that you have a final pay or substantial portion thereof ready for delivery. And in this case, nobody testified, and to the effect that there would be, that it was ready for delivery. And in fact, they testified completely opposite to that. And that was the finding of fact by the military judge, that it was not ready for delivery for quite a few reasons. First of all, the final computation had not been done by the technician there on base. And that wouldn't have been the only step necessary. She would have not needed...
That's the final figure. I'm not concentrating on that. I'm saying a significant part, which is what statute says.
Absolutely, sir. However, in order...
Are you saying that in practice the two are conflated and that nothing's ready for delivery until everything's ready for delivery and what statute says is surplusage?
No, sir. I think you can have a substantial portion of it ready for delivery. I'm unaware of a case that or instance that had that, those facts, but that certainly could exist. However, the point is, these steps needed to be taken not only to come to the final pay, as opposed to a substantial portion, but to come to it being ready for delivery. Nothing was ready for delivery. DFAS could not act unilaterally. These steps had to be taken first in order for it to be delivered to him. Without those steps being taken, he was going to receive nothing. Now,
What protects, in the off chance that DFAS is not as efficient as they might be, what protects the service member from being held on active duty effectively forever, or beyond 20 days?
Sir, I would agree with the court's opinion that, or the question to my respected colleague previously, that there is no case law whereby you violate your own statute and then the member is held indefinitely on, or not
the statute,
sorry, I apologize, the regulation, and then is held indefinitely subject to personal jurisdiction. I would say that it would fall within this 20-day window that was...
Is it the government's position today that the government would not have court-martial jurisdiction over someone if after 20 days there is not a, whatever, the final pay or substantial part of that pay was not ready for delivery? Does the government concede today that, therefore, after the 20-day mark, the government would no longer have court-martial jurisdiction?
Well, sir, not knowing the facts of future cases, I'm loath to concede that.
Would you agree that it would be a much more difficult case for the government to argue?
I would wholeheartedly agree. It would be much more difficult.
Do you happen to know whether persons who are going through the checkout process are told that they remain subject to court-martial jurisdiction?
I do not know the answer to that, and I would imagine, sir, that that's probably on a base-by-base, case-by-case analysis, as some of the cases that...
So we seem to have a system where the member gets the DD-214 or whatever it is these days, and they go wandering off the base, and unknown to them, they're still subject to UCMJ jurisdiction. That could happen, right?
Well, yes, sir. Absolutely.
For the amount of time that DFAS determines is appropriate.
Yes, sir. And I would state that in each of the cases cited in both appellants and government's briefs, all of those, or not all, but a vast majority of those individuals actually thought, oh, I'm good to go. I'm not under personal jurisdiction of the military anymore. But their belief was certainly not controlling in any one of those instances.
How do you answer the defense's contention that fundamentally, these statutes, and to a lesser extent, these regulations, are predicated on a situation that doesn't exist anymore, where they all lined up in front of a table with a big stack of cash and an officer with a 45 behind it and signed for it and got cash in hand. Nobody gets cash in hand. almost nobody gets a check in the mail. It's all electronically done. And how does that cut in this situation? Are you basically at the mercy of DFAS? Does court-martial jurisdiction hang on, as the Chief Judge said earlier, the efficiency or inefficiency of DFAS to make electronic payments and the commercial banking system?
Yes, sir. First off, with regard to the argument proposed by appellant that there be an actual delivery, no, that has not been the argument set forth by the government, and we do not feel that that's necessary, that there actually be actually handing off of that cash. Certainly, as was noted, technology advancements, direct deposit, things of that nature. However, what I'll note is the statute, that doesn't necessarily mean, oh, hey, the statute written at that time when that was the case is therefore no good, because the statute was well written. It didn't state on final delivery. Rather, it stated when it's ready for delivery.
Judge Suki, if I could reject the question at that point. The statute as it was originally written, what did it have to do with court-martial jurisdiction?
I'm sorry, sir.
When was the statute originally written?
I believe it was in the 50s, 60s, sir.
Wasn't it the Service Means Three Adjustment Act of 1944? It was designed to ensure that people were paid before they were discharged and that their pay status was taken care of before they were discharged?
Yes, sir.
Is there anything in the face of the legislation or the legislative history itself that says you can get a discharge certificate and still be subject to court-martial jurisdiction?
No, I don't believe there was anything.
Was there anything in the legislative history that indicated it was designed to ensure continuation of court-martial jurisdiction until people are paid?
I don't believe there was specifically.
Okay. Is there anything in King that says that this is a mandatory element as opposed to a general requirement?
No, specifically states generally required.
Okay.
Now, counsel, so, I would direct your attention, and I don't know, based on the questions that the Chief Judge is asking, why this Court came out the way that it did in King or Harmon, but it seems to me that the language in King says that, second, there must be a final accounting of pay made. This is an explicit command set forth by Congress. I don't know that that was meant to be optional.
Well, I think the, if I may follow up, I think the general requirement is important to note in the fact that they stated, they also changed it slightly and stated a final accounting. So I can't say specifically that they were setting forth their general requirement with regard to the actual statutory language. So there's a slight differentiation there, though it may be minute. Generally, there should be a final accounting. Explicitly, there must be final pay ready for delivery.
Now, if an individual, let's take a hypothetical here focusing on the final accounting of pay. Suppose we have a circumstance just like the case we had before us, but there's no disciplinary action contemplated. And let's say that the individual involved who's being separated is a crackerjack IT specialist, and he receives his 214 and goes home. 19 days later, there's a major computer crash in the unit, and the major says to the first sergeant, get Jones and have him fix it. And they realize that Jones has been discharged by order of the lieutenant, as in this case. Can they order Jones to military service? And then if he says, gee, I was glad to do my service, but now I've got a civilian job, no thanks, then court-martial him for being AWOL?
If I may, sir, I believe it summarized that your essential point is whether or not, simply as a computer glitch, the final authorization was not completed.
The judge in this case focused solely on final accounting of pay. Let's say we have an exact same situation, because whatever we rule in this case is going to deal not only with court-martial jurisdiction with respect to past disciplinary offense, it's going to deal with the ability to order people to active duty and to court-martial them if they decline. So suppose you have an individual, like we have many individuals now, who are being separated from military service, and they're separated under the exact same conditions as the individual in this case. Can the military order that individual who has the DD-14 back to active duty on the grounds that he didn't receive his final accounting of pay under the circumstances of this case? And then if the individual says, sorry, I was glad to do my duty, but now I have a civilian job, the military can then say, no, you're in violation of Article 86. We're not only going to call you back to active duty, but we're going to court-martial you for not showing up yesterday.
I guess, sir, I would go back to the regulation in conjunction with the statute. And if that occurred within those 20 days in which they were to complete it, then I would say, yes, he is still subject to jurisdiction. However, if it were beyond that time period, that would be much less likely.
So all service members are subject to being recalled to active duty for at least 20 days if DFAS decides to take that long to contemplate their, to complete the making the pay ready or substantial part ready for delivery.
Under the current existing regulations and law, yes, sir. The appellant has requested that you completely disregard this requirement and merge it with the third element of King. However, as given essentially really no reason to just merge it with that and disregard what is required by statute. And
the appellant's making a legal policy argument that you need a definite date, a definite and uniform date of discharge. Do you agree with the appellant's assertion that this basically makes it ununiform and dependent upon the efficiency of each individual base finance office?
To a certain extent, yes, sir.
Okay. So there is no uniform date of discharge because it depends on the efficiency or inefficiency of local people.
Yes and no. No, to a certain extent, that within a certain boundary.
Within 20 days.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'll agree with that.
Counsel, I guess my question is, it seems to me that the issue of whether or not this court has jurisdiction depends upon whether we can fit the individual within Section 2 of the UCMJ, Article 2 of the UCMJ. Would you agree with that?
Yes, ma'am.
And it seems to me that King and Harmon, what they're trying to do is interpret or perhaps find a way to fit this scenario within the subsection A1, members of the regular component of the armed forces, including those awaiting discharge after expiration of their terms of enlistment. But other than that, I'm not sure where this pay point even comes into whether someone falls in under Article 2.
I guess, ma'am, the fact is that both Harmon and King looked at it in terms of this is the statutory language by Congress. In addition, if Congress were concerned that this, their purpose in enacting this statute has led to this disparity, as the opponent has stated, within the last 60 years, could have certainly changed it. However, they did not. So to a certain extent, I would argue that Section 1168 and Section 1169 are applicable, as King and this Court previously determined. The case law over the last 50 years has essentially remained the same with regard to these requirements being necessary. I mean, King was much more recent. However, in each of these cases, they've always looked to Section 1168 and then Section 1169.
To determine whether or not a person has been discharged.
To determine whether or not a person has been discharged. Yes, ma'am. So I would, in light of the rapid change by Congress and stare decisis, would find that it is applicable.
Is there any statutory authority for the requirement that the member have completed a checkout procedure, the third element of King?
I would state that Section 1169 essentially has been, I guess it's been interpreted to require that, in that Section 1169 states that no regular enlisted member of an armed force may be discharged before his term of service except as prescribed by the Secretary of Concern.
And that's what was done in this case. It was directed by the Secretary.
For the MEB, sir?
For the, yes.
Yes, sir. I understood. However,
I'm just trying to figure out where that requirement came from, because I don't see it in 1168 or 1169.
My interpretation, sir, is that it's taken from 1169 and that the Secretary and then down through to the Armed Services Secretaries and the regulations for the clearing process of an individual from the military, and that's where it comes from. I understand.
Could it come from a concept, both with respect to the clearing process and the accounting pay, of trying to determine whether the discharge was erroneous or not? Aren't the King factors that we use for determining whether or not there was an erroneous discharge? That is, that the 214 was not, in fact, the action that the government was taking at that time, but it was a mistake, a clerical mistake, a mistake to follow, a hold. Those are all factors that are taken into account.
Yes, sir. However, I think that the military courts, in an effort to, based off of the statutes, have somewhat of a bright line rule, or as much as can be, have utilized those elements and found them to be, yes, you need to cross the T and dot the I in that regard. And that is what effectuates it. And this court, for the reason that this court stated in United States versus Keels.
You may take the time to finish your thought and make a concluding remark.
Thank you, sir. In United States versus Keels, at 432, this court stated these provisions, and it's referencing, Article 71 and Section 1168. These provisions are designed to protect service members from premature separation. Section 1168 ensures that a member will not be separated from the service, thereby depriving the member and the member's family of pay and benefits such as medical care until both the formal discharge certificate and a substantial part of any pay due are ready for delivery. So I think that these were, yes, to look at whether or not there had been an erroneous discharge, but the purpose is that, or the intent is that there be a bright line rule for that reason, to avoid premature separation of members. For their benefit, however, yes, it does maintain jurisdiction. So these T's need to be crossed, these I's need to be dotted.
What's the bright line rule?
So that there be a separation of pay,
and the bright line is that it occurs at some point when DFAS decides it occurs. Yeah. That's the bright line?
Yes, sir, and it falls within, a 20-day window.
Right, a bright line which lacks, as you've already admitted, uniformity.
Yes, sir. However, it is a line. for these reasons, the United States requests that you affirm the findings of the military trial judge, as well as the Air Force Criminal Court of Appeals, that personal jurisdiction has been maintained over appellant.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
May it please the court. Per the statute and King, a substantial portion of the appellant's pay was ready for delivery for him on his date of separation, even if the administrative details had not been resolved by finance and DFAS. The appellant could have received a substantial portion of his pay on his date of separation. The DFAS procedures, corrections, and adjustments after the fact should not determine jurisdiction.
If he had walked in there that day and said, give me 75% of what you think I'm due, would they have given it to him?
No, Your Honor.
No, they wouldn't have. No. Why? Because DFAS wouldn't let him. So how is it ready?
It's ready because they knew what
a substantial portion of what he was owed. They knew what his debts were, and the DFAS inefficiency should not govern in this case. As the government contended just before they sat down, their bright-line rule that they'd like to employ is, it appears to be, that the military retains jurisdiction until 20 days after the date of separation. But that's going to cause disparate results, and it's basically putting court-martial jurisdiction in the hands of DFAS and the local finance office.
Well, why don't you argue then that to the extent that we suggest that the requirements of 1168 have to be met in order for personal jurisdiction to be divested, that King is wrong, that Harmon is wrong? I mean, isn't that the argument you should be making instead of trying to somehow say that this pay was quote-unquote ready for delivery?
I don't know that it's necessarily wrong, Your Honor, because I do think that that the elements are there as sort of the standard for
personal jurisdiction?
Yes, ma'am. But under the facts of this case, final pay or a substantial part of that pay was ready for delivery to the appellant under these facts and circumstances. And we can't let the DFAS regulation govern when jurisdiction ends.
Okay, but you just said in response to Judge Stuckey's question that they could not have given him the pay because it wasn't ready. I mean, DFAS would not let it be given to him. So how is it ready for delivery?
And I guess maybe I wasn't clear enough in my answer to Judge Stuckey. It wasn't ready because DFAS wouldn't give it to him because under DFAS's own procedures, they absolutely refused to pay until the different hurdles in the regulation are...
Until they had conducted a final accounting, right?
According to their definition, yes, ma'am. The reading of the DFAS regulation basically would allow the Air Force to reach the same result they were trying to reach in the very old case of United States versus Scott, where they were trying to define a specific time for discharge. And under this reading of the rule the government wants you to employ, if somebody hasn't received their final pay until 20 days, the government retains court-martial jurisdiction until that point in time. If for some reason the person had been paid on their date of separation or their date of separation plus one day, then presumably they are no longer subject to court-martial jurisdiction. This is an unjustified disparate result.
Is there anything in the record that indicates why his ETS was March 4th?
His date of separation was the 3rd of March, Your Honor.
3rd of March?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the day he started the checkout, going through the checkout list?
No, Your Honor, if I may have some more time to answer a question.
You may take the time to refer to the record if you need to and answer the question.
Thank you, sir. The appellant had his initial out-processing appointment with the MPF sometime after the 24th of January. That was when he was notified to start out processing the base. And a review.
And when did he start out processing?
I believe he started sometime in January. Appellate Exhibit 5 is his out processing checklist for all of the base agencies. And if you look at that, there's various dates from January through
so he started well ahead of time. When did he first go to financial services or whatever?
I have just a moment, Your Honor.
Does February 24th sound right?
Ma'am, that was his final out-processing with finance, but he had an earlier meeting with Ms. Kane where he picked up the finance-specific checklist, and if I can just have a moment, I can get the page number.
You may do that. You might find it in the military judge's findings as well.
Well, I can sort that out. I don't want to tie you up here.
Yes, Your Honor. I know it's in both Appellate Exhibit 21 and Appellate Exhibit 5. So he had started his out-processing, just his general clearing of the base, well in advance. He had his initial out-processing with finance sometime, I believe it's around the 4th or 5th of February, where he got the finance-specific checklist. That checklist is contained in Appellate Exhibit 20, and it shows him going to the various agencies on base to get them to sign off whether or not he had a debt. The only one, as I mentioned earlier, was to AFIS. And then he had his final out processing with finance on the 24th of February. So nothing that he did prevented his discharge. He had started well in advance of his date of separation, which was on the 3rd. I believe that the 5th of March, which the government counsel quoted as the date of separation, was something that was in an email from one of the captains at the legal office to finance saying he's out processing the base today. That email was an error. He had finalized his out processing long before then, had received his DD-214 on the 3rd of March. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And not to prolong the argument, but since much of the last 2 minutes was taken up with factual matters, if the government has anything further to add with respect to the record, we could hear that. Otherwise, we will conclude the case. Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 5 minutes before 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Court stands in recess until 9:55.